Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I've written a windy screed for today's program, using up a lot of time and paper, each of which is running short. I intend to follow the writing wherever it goes, and I call it September Song. On the first day of September 80 years ago in 1939, Nazi Germany, under the dictatorship of Adolf Hitler, invaded Poland and started World War II. Not as much attention is given the nearly simultaneous attack on Poland's rear by Communist Russia under the dictatorship of Joseph Stalin, Man of Steel. This was the agreed-upon treachery practiced by both parties to a false-hearted treaty that temporarily postponed merciless war upon each other, while each grabbed the spoils of other nations without interference from each other. September ends on this last year of millennial adolescence in very close proximity to the cusp of yet another war in the Middle East. In simplified corporate speak, big money alliances by the Bush family and Trump World, Inc. with Saudi Arabia's ruling family means that the USA appears in ruptured bipartisan conflict, choosing sides in the ancient and endless war between Islamic Sunnis and Shiites. There must be a tale in Aesop about all of this. This is become especially a time, as Rudyard Kipling wrote in a famous poem, to keep our heads when all others seem to be losing theirs. The only factor that gives any and all of us a chance in this sorry world is the right and freedom to express our unhindered opinions and beliefs. A passionate and significant debate is being conducted across America concerning the shaky future we collectively face. The marvelous French historian and novelist, author of The World Is Not Enough and The Crusades, Zoe Oldenburg, wrote about relations between Christians, Jews, and Muslims in Jerusalem, the rock and heavenly city of all three religions during the Crusades, which were also known as the period the Dark Ages. As soon as a glimmer for mutual understanding appeared, she wrote, it was very quickly rendered impossible. Palestine-Israel is the focal point of the vortex. It is where two very different peoples clash over ancestral land, each disputably claims indisputably, which exacerbates every other conflict in Islam and might be the real prophesied Armageddon. For the USA and Europe, Israel is the brave little outpost of Judaism struggling to sustain its recaptured biblical promised land, Zion, which is also synonymous with Judean heaven and Jerusalem, the holy city. To the Arab peoples, it is an upstart cancer that usurped ancient Arabic lands and cultures, which once tolerated Judaism, but loathes modern oppressive Zionism that disinherited them. Jewish Israelites relentlessly attempt to eradicate the Palestinians or banish them from Israel. A division into separate states has been nullified by the current right-wing government, and most recently by Better Jews Than Muslims, presidency of Donald Trump. But recent elections have removed absolutist Zionists from nearly absolute power in Israel just this month. A great many Israelis say that nearly everyone in Israel, both Jewish and Palestinian, wants peace, which seems evident from the most recent election. But they feel caught up in a hopeless conundrum because no one knows how to make peace, not even, perhaps especially, the extremists of either side. Not so long as two very different peoples fervently desire the same real estate, not for wealth or prospect, but because it is known to Jews and Palestinians alike as God's land. Despite the immediate and enduring clamors for retribution for 9/11 18 years ago this month, a Pearl Harbor analogy of immediately uniting Americans for war against Japan and Germany a few days later should not create a sinister parallel these many years later by persecuting American Muslims or other citizens of Arabic descent, as our predecessors of the previous millennium did with Japanese Americans in World War II. The Pearl Harbor analogy with 9/11 can only go so far. Complete surprise, a direct hit on the USA's wealth and power, epic destruction. The anger and instant desire for revenge were about the same as Pearl Harbor. Also, the heart-wrenching scale of tragedy and the immediate finger-pointing at why 9/11 was allowed to happen. Lingering suspicion 18 years later of government foreknowledge of 9/11 has also been a Pearl Harbor legacy. What did the government know, and why did it know it? That would be the explosive question, followed by, are we misled, you know, by our leaders? Do our global policies reflect the foundations of our purposes as a nation and a democratic government? Or has the presidency of Donald Trump fatally eroded truth and honesty as the bulwarks of American democracy here and at large? George W. Bush's favorite newspaper columnist, the late Charles Krauthammer, elicited the so-called Bush Doctrine prior to 9/11. Quote, in the liberal internationalist view, the U.S. is merely one among many. A stronger country, yes, but one that has to adapt itself to the will and needs of the international community. This is folly. America is no mere international citizen. It is the most dominant power in the world, more dominant since Rome. As though he were a Roman orator, Krauthammer said that America was in the position to reshape norms, alter expectations, and create new realities. How? By unapologetic and implacable demonstrations of will. And that was Krauthammer. This is not an attitude very interested in winning hearts and minds. It is what the late, great Molly Ivins called the G. Gordon Liddy School of Foreign Policy. She called Krauthammer the boy Bismarck and asked, how many times was Rome assaulted by barbarians? Quite a few, according to Gibbon. And there it is. If it's Rome the government wishes to emulate, then America is being set up as an exclusive homeland. Fortress America, with a K. Patriotism is the key word and justification for domestic repression. Dissent is, as usual, barely tolerated even during what might still be considered normal times, but is repudiated in periods of national crises when it is most necessary, which seems to be swiftly approaching. Yet it ought to be remembered that our first patriots were traitors and were also, as they would be labeled today, terrorists. In their case, a small, determined group attempting liberty from a mass of overseas tyranny by terrorism and murders of government officials and supporters known as Tories. Revolution is mass terrorism written large. The only true method of winning a war against terrorism is to do our honest best to remove its cause. That means we must live up to our own self-proclaimed ideals of equality, justice, and liberty for all, with a hearty dose of fairness. Fighting terrorism is a lot like stamping out fires with your feet. They spring back up again and again, their flames above ground scattered by the stamping feet, but especially from fires gone underground that burn great distances among vast root systems to pop up and restart fires thought to have been extinguished. With 9/11, the U.S. had finally been attacked in a similar manner that the American police-keeping military has assaulted countries all over the world for one purpose or another for nearly a century. The USA has been the masters of air warfare. We pioneered most of the ways war can be made from the sky and used it more times than any other. Grim examples of devastation by non-nuclear bombing campaigns against North Korea and South Vietnam nearly wrecked them as civilizations. at least since the first Persian Gulf War of 1990-91, the U.S. has put an iron umbrella over the Near East to guard our oil lines, striking with aircraft and missiles at targets in countries that dispute our virtual monopoly over their most lucrative regional product. The outcry over missile attacks on Saudi Arabia were nearly Old Testament by the USA's Vice President and Secretary of State, and of course only one-sided, without mentioning the Holocaust upon an Arabic people perpetrated by the Saudis and the USA, bombing them back to the Stone Age, a barbarous American Air Force general menacingly said about the U.S. air war in both Vietnams. We lost Vietnam because we refused to acknowledge any legitimacy to the other side. In our bumpy wars in the Middle East, we continue to tread the same ground. Our military propaganda industry assures the civilian stay-at-homes that the nations we invade or incurge upon welcome our troops as liberators, like you might remember in Somalia. Perhaps we need to remember the Egyptian Gamal Nasser and his dream of a pan-Arabia. That dream is not dead, nor has it died with Osama bin Laden, who seemed to long for a caliphate of Arabian night times. That call for Arab unity would not have included the old-fashioned dictator of Iraq, Saddam Hussein. During crises not covered in the Constitution, the president is given great powers. Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president, suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, which sanctioned military arrest of persons without formally charging them with violating the law. During World War II, the U.S. government interned thousands of Japanese-American citizens. There is a grave danger when disaster is overflated to justify curtailing the Bill of Rights. In the very near future, voices of dissent against criminal theft of democracy might be under violent attack while attempts to intimidate and squelch legally or extra-legally opposing opinions will be baffle-gab. The McDisney image of this new century millennium, the McDisney images of this new century millennium are revealed as the insipid fantasies they really were. It is a drastically dissimilar world we now perceive for the future, nearly two decades later. Yet it is the same old world of danger and death it has always been, never mind how long we have been able to fabricate a fable of fabulous facade. Our center of gravity has drastically shifted, and we look out upon a newer milieu of uncertainty with wrenching pangs of anxiety, dread, and grim determination to survive each day that would be familiar to our earliest ancestors. With 9/11, the U.S. had finally been attacked on its homeland, and right away, immediately after 9/11, the USA should have cooperated with the World Court and the United Nations. Although the U.S. government under G.W. Bush neglected to apply to the United Nations as arbiter of the 9/11 attacks, as Franklin Roosevelt had intended to overcome the failure of the League of Nations to prevent World War II, the U.N. did provide the USA with its sham call for a second war against Iraq and against Saddam Hussein in particular. As September disappears with summer, we are allowing ourselves to be committed to war when it is not only unnecessary, it would be an absurdist conception of crime. We have lived quite a while in a false bubble that whatever we do elsewhere in the world will not in similar measure or substance strike back. Now at a time span we should seek justice, we threaten instead, though the signals from the White House are notoriously mixed and inconsistent. War is murder on a mass scale. Terrorism overkill. War also limits prerogatives available to peaceably attain the real justice an armed crusade only rarely provides, if it does at all. It is ironic the USA refuses to fully support the World Court, perhaps a result of a judgment against the U.S. by Nicaragua. There seems also a contradiction that American so-called peacekeepers are not above international law as they search and destroy suspected terrorists in third world countries. These murders are at our door. We are as guilty as terrorists. This is the responsibility of free citizens of a democracy. If we are at war to defend democracy, we had better ensure the responsibilities of a democracy in its conduct. In other words, we must firmly declare personally and as a people the war's limits as well as its targets. Our Achilles tendon has been perpetually exposed by the 9/11 attack nearly two decades ago. And like Achilles, we will never eliminate its vulnerability to attack and harm. The earlier analogy of firefighting might be applicable if you cannot put out or control a fire, attempt at least to contain it each time it erupts from a low flame. But this fire has been burning for millennia, an exceptionally long time, and each time it erupts in one form or another, its consequences are worse than ever. Perhaps after the war is finished, whenever and if ever, and the familiar shock of its costs and repercussions numb everybody all over again, many more citizens might wish they had been more sympathetic to voices of protest they spurn or even denounce. How empty, how sickish, how senseless everything suddenly seems when a war is over, Edmund Wilson once wrote. Only when we actually accept citizenship in the world and use our superpower as it was intended to be used, will we adequately protect our vulnerability, which is exacerbated by the way we presently treat the larger world as either friend or foe. It would help if we were not a predatory species, but that's who we are. We initially organized society while killing animals and modified it, killing fellow humans in other families and tribes, which we have never stopped doing. We are a global civilization. Nuclear weapons have rendered the nation state as dead as dinosaurs. We, as citizens of a free nation, must ultimately make the decisions of war and peace. And although the difficulties to impress our collective will upon government are extremely rarefied, the beginning is to call through what seems incredible and conflicting chaos and respond with clarity. This is the responsibility concomitant with freedom. One thing that seems certain, similar to the assassination of John Kennedy 56 years ago, the attack against the USA 18 years ago on 9/11 burst our personal bubbles, and our private obsessions were reduced microscopically small to be petty and irrelevant. Throughout the confusion and turmoil resembling a dark and murky kaleidoscopic backdrop to life in the pre-2020s, I hope we have not forgotten that the primary purpose of being American is not about shopping. The science fiction writers might be right that it is essential to get some of our eggs off the home planet if the species is to have a chance for a future in the universe. And now I will read a newspaper feature written about an Oregon horsewoman I have known since she was born. Her name is Winter Palmatier, and she is 15 this past August 5th, and she is the granddaughter of Julie Conception, who I've known since she was 25, many moons ago. Winter is a superb and award-winning horsewoman who has been riding horses since before she could walk. The newspaper is the Estacada News. The writer is Emily Lindstrand, winner of quite a few press awards. The story was printed August 8th, just prior to the Oregon State Fair, and just after Winter's birthday. A ride to the fair. Estacada resident will compete with rehabilitated horse by Emily Lindstrand. Winter Palmatier has been participating in equestrian activities since she was a toddler, and she will soon take a horse that she's been rehabilitating to the Oregon State Fair. Winter, a 15-year-old incoming sophomore at Estacada High School, qualified for the statewide competition held Friday, August 23rd through Monday, September 3rd in Salem during the Clackamas County 4-H Fair. When Winter and her family adopted 9-year-old Missy 2 years ago, she was underweight and easily startled. She would often buck, lowering her head and raising her hindquarters, which made her difficult to ride. We never knew when she'd try to buck or be fine, Winter said, noting that riding Missy is sometimes akin to being on a roller coaster. Sometimes she wants to go fast, and sometimes she goes slowly and doesn't want to go anywhere. There's not an in-between. However, in spite of these challenges, Winter saw something in Missy that made her want to bring the horse to the fair. She needed a job, and she had a lot of potential, Winter said. During the 4-H horse fair, Winter and Missy participated in barrel racing, flag racing, pulling figure eights, and key racing. At the state fair, the duo will compete in flag and barrel racing. They earned a championship in flag racing during the county event. It was a shock, Winter said, discussing their win at the county competition. From then on, I haven't stopped working with her. Because of Missy's background, Winter took several additional precautions to prepare her for the sights and sounds of the fair, including waving a flag, shaking a bottle full of rocks, and using pool noodles to prepare her for the excitement at the fair. We took extra steps to desensitize her. We're transitioning away from that now and focusing more into the riding, she said. Winter's mother, Tony, noted that this type of training has required Winter to return to basics again after years of riding. They had to go back to the beginning and build their way up, Tony said. Winter's mother, Tony, noted that this type of training has required Winter to return to basics again after years of riding. They had to go back to the beginning and build their way back up, Tony said. Winter has been training with Missy daily to prepare for the state competition. We work on the events and try to get her ready for all of the competition and excitement at the fair, she said. Before, she couldn't even trot a pattern. Now she's doing a full-speed run. Along with the state fair, Winter and her brother Caleb, 11, will also show goats at the Clackamas County Fair. The fair will show both dairy and meat goats and sell market goats during the junior livestock event. I enjoy showing meat animals, Winter said. Dairy goats are very dainty. Two common questions Winter typically gets asked while showing animals are if the goats are pregnant and why she cuts their ears off. We don't do that. The goats we show, they're La Mancha goats, and they don't have ears with a longer flop, she explained. Goats have big stomachs. They like to eat a lot of grain and hay. When bringing the goats to the fair's arena, judges ask a variety of questions. They might ask general questions like how to keep a goat, Winter said. In the arena, you walk a lot slower, make direct eye contact with the judges, and try to present the goats as best as you can. Sometimes 4-H members put their problem-solving skills to use at the fair, including instances when they need to show multiple animals simultaneously. You work with the other 4-H members, Winter said. I've shown other people's goats for them as well. In 4-H, we have a very close relationship and we work together well. The goats can also get into mischief. They've tried to eat my ribbons before, Winter said. Winter is passionate about working with her animals, particularly her horses. Along with Missy, she has two other horses named Denali and Sophie. I never remember a time I haven't been riding them, Winter said, noting that the longest she's been away from her horses is when she and her family went to Disneyland for a week. She appreciates having grown up around the animals. I love being around horses and having the privilege to ride them as often as I do, she said. And that was A Ride to the Fair by Emily Lindstrand for the Estacada News back in August about Winter Palmateer, who is of three separate races. She is white. She is brown, and she is black. She is actually Asian Filipina, and she's black African. All three had a great mixture. And now, Johnny Appleseed, aka Chapman, was born today, September 26, 1774. He is considered an American pioneer and an orchidist, primarily of apples, which were popular wherever he went exploring and planting apple trees, because white settlers were very fond of hard cider, their only truly reliable supply of liquor as a result of the great pioneer's apple orchards, legendarily planted everywhere he went in the West. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake, Ocean Park, Washington, Let's boycott you-know-who. Consider this modest proposal. Let's boycott you-know-who, whose everyday obsession is to be noticed and loved. You-know-who dominates the media, and some of us yearn for much-needed respite. After all, you-know-who yearns for constant media attention, while crucial matters like the climate crisis, justice for all, and massive corruption receive token attention. We need a day off or more to indulge in some beneficial stoic behavior, like celebrating the great achievements of our past, looking forward to a more enriching future, or above all, grasping the present. Think about it. You know who is a narcissist who might get caught holding his own hand in lover's lane. Every day in America, we celebrate something special or not so special. For instance, today, September 26th, is National Lobster Day, National Dumpling Day, and Johnny Appleseed Day. Come to think of it, Johnny Appleseed was famous for planting seeds. Maybe we should plant the seed of silence, avoiding any mention of you-know-who. That's challenging, since it would mean avoiding television, radio, the internet, and people wearing MAGA hats. But I think it's worth the candle. For at least one day, I will say, you-know-who, I've had enough of you. And that was Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. And this is Michael McCusker. On the last day of September, 130 years ago in 1889, Wyoming became the first state of these United States to grant women the right to vote. 21 years later, on August 26, 1920, American women finally got to vote equally with men with the 19th Amendment. The U.S. House of Representatives approved women's suffrage 100 years ago in May 1919. By August 26, 1920, the required 35 states had ratified it. 2020 should have more meaning than eyesight or a presidential election, even this presidential election. It should stand for equality between men and women. 2020.